What else? Class as usual if no one shows up. The beat goes on. And with half of the class here, what more could we ask for? The smarter half of the class is here. Matt's not coming?
So we only have us two. Hopefully that does. If not, then the smallest class in history.
Well, I've got a lab with three people in it, so. Well, questions? Everything's so perfectly clear, you just whizzed through the homework.
Are you going to be here on Saturday?
I should be, but I never guarantee that.
Well, that doesn't really matter.
I do have an exam I have to write sometime for those wonderful 106ers.
Me and Matt are going to get just me too, 100% We said that.
So I think the exam is a week from Friday.
I believe that.
I think that's true. And I think we have, I think on our Friday, we'll cover the last of chapter 3. So
it's on the first three chapters.
It'll be on the first three chapters. And the appendix. So kind of the last thing we had left over from linear algebra per se is something that I quibbled the name about. Willie Gibbs told me that the right name to call these things is dyadics, because they're kind of two things next to each other. Other common names are outer product and tensor product, and they're both a little bit ambiguous because the mathematicians mean something a little bit different about those things than we do. Mathematicians don't know anything about dyadics, so if you mention that word, they'll at least know that they don't know anything, which is maybe an advantage. A good name would be ket bra, because that's what they are. Instead of having a bra ket, we have a ket bra, and we can then write the operator in a somewhat convenient fashion. But no one calls these things ket bras. If we have this formalism, then we can write some things in some compact ways. So if we take any orthonormal basis, we can write the identity operator in terms of a sum of ket bras. We can write a diagonal form for something like a Hermitian matrix by using the basis that's provided by the eigenvectors of that Hermitian matrix. And I don't know, here's a projection operator in three-dimensional space that's written. What it does is it throws out the z component of a vector, and therefore if you do that twice, you still have exactly what you started with. So it's an operator where p squared equals p, which seems like if you cancel the p, it's going to tell you that p is equal to 1. But it doesn't have an inverse, so you can't cancel the p. Questions on those guys? They're real common in relativity, where it's a common way of making, probably the most common way of making tensors. So tensor product is what somebody in relativity would call this. As I say, unfortunately, the mathematicians mean something a little bit different about that. So then we went on to talk about quantum mechanics, and I don't know, this stuff should be pretty familiar, except the claim that the things that we've talked about previously as being specific to energy actually apply to any physical quantity. So I claim that for every physical quantity, there exists a Hermitian operator, and the eigenvalues of that operator, which you typically just a bunch of mathematics define, are the only possible results that you could actually measure if you had sufficient precision. So the only thing left to talk about is what's the probability of measuring one of those particular values. And there's the answer. You take the wave function that describes the system and you dot it with the eigenvectors of the Hermitian operator, and you get then the probability. So this is equal to the probability of measuring that quantity. Things get a little bit tricky when we're talking about continuous eigenvalues. So the probability of measuring, that the color of your eyes are blue is a number, whereas the probability that the atoms in this room are, that a atom in this room is moving at pi meters a second, is a little bit different. So what we really need is the probability density, the probability that's in some bin divided by the bin size. And while the probability has to be dimensionless, probability density has to have the units of 1 over the bin size. So something has to change, and what has to change is the units of these basis vectors. So for discrete eigenvalues, we had a Kronecker delta, which of course is 0 or 1, so this integral had to be dimensionless, and so each one of these guys had to be providing a 1 over square root of length to cancel the dx. Now we've done everything one-dimensional. I hope it won't come surprise that if we up that to 3 dimensions, then the units of psi are going to be 1 over the square root of volume. But in any case, we get this extra dimension when we're talking about continuous eigenvectors. But otherwise, it works pretty much the same. Once you have this Dirac delta function normalization, then if we write psi as a sum, which is of course an integral for continuous things, we can figure out what these expansion coefficients are just by taking the dot product, the integral, of one of our basis vectors, just like before. It's just like Fourier's trick. And we did this with k because things look a little bit neater, but if we do it with momentum, it works out pretty much the same. The resulting expansion coefficients are called the momentum space wave function. So the idea that's behind a lot of this, which whether you catch on to this or not really won't matter for calculation, but it is a useful picture, but it is a little bit hard to fathom. So the idea is that this ket psi is a vector, and depending what basis vectors you select, we'll get equally good representations of that vector, that all representations are equal, that this ket is exactly the same as some of these expansion coefficients. Now, it is true that if we use the energy eigenfunctions, we get a little bit of a special basis because then these expansion coefficients have simple time dependence. In general, the time dependence of these expansion coefficients is going to come about from this integral, which is going to be ugly. And kind of the reason that works out is that h is what determines the time dependence of the system from the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Questions? Well, we have one other case where we have continuous eigenvalues that we've talked about, and that's position. So how does this work with the position operator? So this is going to seem pretty weird, and it's not going to have much of an effect on anything, but it's one of those things that's good to know, I guess. So x is an operator. What function can I multiply that by so that I get a constant times that function back? It doesn't look good, right? Because if I cancel off the f of x, what I say is that x, which is a variable, is equal to a constant, which isn't true. X is an indeterminate. It has to be any old number. So, I mean, that's a hint. The only time you can't cancel f of x is if f of x is 0. So it must be that f of x is usually 0. And in fact, if you think about it, what works is delta of x minus a. for x not equal to a, both sides are zero. And when x equals a, we have the same thing. So the delta function is the eigenfunction of the position operator. Does it satisfy this required Dirac delta function normalization, right? So what that would say is that the integral of delta of x minus b, x minus a, the delta function is real, so complex conjugating doesn't achieve anything. Delta x minus b dx, is that equal to delta of a minus b? Well, sure, right? Because if this were any function of x, the answer would be f of b. So put my b in there. Well, delta function is also symmetric, so this is the same as b minus a. Doesn't really matter. Okay. So what are the expansion coefficients? Right. So what is the probability density for finding the position, for finding the particle at some position? Well, according to that equation, what I need to do is to take my wave function, my normalized wave function, and overlap it with the actual wave function of the system and do the integration, and you know, lo and behold, I get what I knew from the start. Okay, so we can think about position as being just another operator with eigenfunctions, and all of this stuff works out just fine, even though it all looks a little bit odd. And if we carry this through kind of to the ultimate level, then we shouldn't really be thinking about psi of x as being special. Psi of x is just the case where we've expressed psi in terms of the basis vectors of the position operator. So really, we should be saying that this is what psi of x is. It's this arbitrary vector psi expressed in the basis that the that we have eigenfunctions of position. And so you'll occasionally see that notation, and it is a useful notation, but it's not one that I'm going to super advertise. So what I've been saying all along is that psi without the x is psi of x. And it won't hurt you to think that. But what Dirac would invite you to think of is that there's nothing special about position. It's just another operator, and they're all equally good. So we can express psi in terms of these expansion coefficients, whether they are from a continuous operator like x or p, or a discrete operator like maybe the energy. Well, so if we take this one step further, and you can turn off if you want at this point, what does it mean if I take, take my P operator and I operate it on those two things? So what we have said is that this G was some G of X and this F was some F of X. And what this was the integral of f complex conjugated x h bar over I derivative with respect to x of g of x dx. If I adopt Dirac's idea that really this is what psi of x is, this is still going to be a true equation, but it's going to be a true equation that's come at a little bit indirectly. That is to say that we could evaluate this just as well by taking the momentum space representation for these things. Right? So this wave function corresponds to some momentum space operator. And then momentum in momentum space is just p. It's just an integral over p. And any other thing is any other thing, right? We could evaluate that bracket any way we want. So if we adopt that notation, how do we get from A to B? How do we bridge this gap? And the answer is going to look a little bit funny. What we do is we insert some ones. So this is F, the unit operator, P, the unit operator, G. That's for sure. But one way I can write the unit operator is as a sum of the eigenvectors of the X operator. So what I have here then is F of the sum, and I don't want to use the same variable, so I'll use go like that. Then I have my P operator, and then I have the sum of X, X, G, I guess I called it. So these sums are really integrals. This thing here is G of X. This thing here, with combined with that, is really F complex conjugate of F. And what we're left over with then is X prime P X. And that should look exactly like the formulas we've had for the matrix representations of an operator. We put basis vectors on either side. And all I need to say is that this matrix is really a delta function, and then H bar over I derivative with respect to X. Okay, so one of these integrals kills this delta function, and then I'm left just with the integral. This should have been an X prime. X complex conjugate X H bar over I derivative with respect to X of G of X dx. Okay, so that's neither here nor there. It's notation that that allows us to think about the wave function as being something divorced from position, something that actually exists independent of any notions of what we're talking about. And it's a neat idea, but it doesn't necessarily help you calculate anything, because usually what you're able to find is psi of x, not this arbitrary vector psi. Okay, so I don't know if you're turned on by Dirac's neat idea. I don't know that I'm turned on by Dirac's neat idea. It is a neat idea. He wrote one of the shortest books on quantum mechanics. It's about that thick, which has everything in it. So it's very, very compressed. Okay, so let's take a look at an example of how we use all of this stuff together. So let's say that we have and let's go to finite matrices just because it's going to be easy. Let's say we have a Hamiltonian, which better be a Hermitian matrix. So that's a symmetric matrix if A and B are real. So I'll let A and B be real, so that symmetric matrix is Hermitian. I would like this thing to have the units of energy. So I'm just going to write H bar omega, where omega is some constant that give me the proper units for a Hamiltonian. So the first thing we need to do is to find the eigenvectors and values. So that's, of course, the statement that H dotted into one of those vectors is some constant. I'll call it lambda times V. So that's H bar omega A B B A. The vector is equal to some constant times that vector. And you can see, I hope, that this thing is just going to go along for the ride. So really what I want to find is the eigenvectors of that simple matrix. And the way we do that, if we don't have Mathematica, is by looking at the characteristic equation where we have subtract x down the diagonal. So where h minus I lambda is non-invertible, the determinant will be zero, and that's what we're seeking. So this characteristic equation, easy to write, easy to solve. And finally, a equals minus, a minus plus b is equal to x. So that tells us that the eigenvalues are h bar omega a minus b and h bar omega a plus b. Well, what are the eigenvectors? So the eigenvectors are in the null space of this matrix. That is to say, a minus x, bb, a minus x. So let me write now the x and y components of my vector. That wants to equal 0. So there's always a trivial solution to that. X and y is 0. We're looking for a non-trivial solution to that, and that will be the corresponding eigenvector. So if I look for v1, I want to put in that x is equal to the top part of that. I've pulled out the omegas again. So what I've got then is, if I put in a minus b into this equation, what I get is bbbb. It's perfectly clear that the two linear equations are linear combinations of each other, right? They're just equal to each other. So that's why we have a non-trivial solution to this set of linear equations. And hope it's pretty clear that this is all the same thing as b times x plus y is equal to 0. So y wants to equal minus x. So a unnormalized solution to this is that. We need to find the normalization constant. If we do the same thing with the other vector, the only thing that changes is now when we have this plus sign, it gets reversed with those minus signs, so we have this. So that means that we've got, if we do this matrix multiplication, we've got minus x plus y being 0, and so that says that y wants to equal plus x. So the eigenvector that corresponds to this guy is that. Okay, finding eigenvectors' values. We're good. Okay, now we want to normalize those guys. And the claim is that the eigenvectors of a Hermitian matrix are orthogonal. Let's check to see that that's the case. So that we have an orthonormal basis that we can deal with. Okay, so V1 dotted with V1, that would be V1 complex conjugated transposed next to V1. Well, everything pretty much is real, so we're going to end up here with is the magnitude of n squared. This times this is going to give us 2, and that wants to equal 1, so the normalization is going to be 1 over the square root of 2. And it works the same way for the other one. And I hope it's clear that they're orthogonal, that if I dot these two guys together, I get 1 minus 1, which is 0. So V1 and V2 now represent an orthonormal basis.
How do you
So what normalization means is that the dot product, which would be an integral in a functional space sort of sense, the dot product wants to equal 1. So if I just carry that through, I get that equation, right? Because this thing here is equal to n complex conjugate, and we'll do the first one, so. And this one here is equal to n times 1 minus 1. So when I do my matrix multiplication, I get 2. Are you happy? Kind of. You can lie to your instructor, huh?
Close enough.
Close enough, huh? So, I mean, this is, you do want to be clear on this because this is something that kind of happens all the time on exams. So let's take a more interesting example. Let's say that we wanted to normalize the vector that was 1, I plus 2, and 3. How would we go about doing that? So what normalization means is find the overall constant n so that if I dot that with itself, I'm going to get 1. So if I take the transpose of this, complex conjugate it, I'm going to, so what I want is v transposed and complex conjugated. And I really should have written this. I will now write it like this. As the row vector that it is. So I do that matrix product. So I get n complex conjugate from this, and then I get 1 minus I plus 2 and 3. And then from the other one itself, I get 1 I plus 2 and 3. N times its complex conjugate is n squared, and now I have to do this process. So I've got a 1 and a 9, that's perfectly clear. If I multiply those two guys together, what do I get?
Why is it negative I and 1?
Because I complex conjugated it.
That's just the middle term that's changed. Nice.
We're happy?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so what is 2 minus I times 2 plus I? Better not be I, because this...
5.
Oh, 5. Okay. I think I believe that. So 2 plus I times 2 minus I, it's going to be 4 plus 1, and then we get those cancellations. So 5. And this all thing has to equal 1, so the normalization has to be 1 over the square root of 15. Okay, so we've got an orthonormal set of eigenvalues of h. Let's solve the initial value problem. So if the initial state is this, what is the future of that state? So now we're solving the initial value problem. So the claim is we have to write this state as a linear combination of the two eigenvectors. And that we can find this coefficient by just taking v1 dotted with the original vector. Right? Just like what we've been doing someplace. And I guess I'm not sure I ever wrote it as an expansion coefficient, but that's what that is. Okay, so this thing here is going to give us a 1 over the square root of 2, and it's going to give a row vector that is 1 minus 1, dot that with the column vector that is 0, 1, and what we're going to get is minus 1. And if we do the same thing with v2, where this is 1, 1, this is going to be plus 1 over the square root of 2. So what we've got then is minus 1 over the square root of 2 of V1 plus 1 over the square root of 2 V2. And if you kind of in your head do that, I hope you can see that these terms are going to cancel because of the minus sign. These terms are going to add. Each one of them is a half. So we are in fact getting this vector that we started with. Okay, so that is how this thing starts out. What is its future? Right, so in the future, we can just figure out what that is by taking this expansion and tacking on e to the minus I appropriate omega t. Where omega is equal to the energy divided by h bar. So this omega 1 is equal to omega a minus b, and this omega 2 is equal to omega a plus b. Okay. Liar. I hope not. So this is a perfectly good answer the way it sits, but let's kind of put it all together so that we can just see the column vector by itself. This is going to take a little bit of algebra, but I hope it won't be too painful. So the first thing to realize is everybody has an overall factor of e to the minus I omega at, so I might as well pull that guy out. And then I've got 1 over the square root of 2, the first vector, e to the plus I omega bt, and there's a minus sign here, right? And then I've got plus 1 over the square root of 2 v2, e to the minus I omega bt. And V1 is, of course, by itself, 1 over the square root of 2, 1 minus 1. And V2 is 1 over the square root of 2, 1, 1. So now all I have to do is just put the top components together and the bottom components together. The 2 square roots of 2 are going to give me a half. So what I've got here is e to the minus I omega at over 2. Everything has that half in it. And for the top term, what I've got is minus plus. So I've got minus e to the plus I omega bt plus e to the minus I omega bt. People believe that? So I'm dealing with the top, I'm trying to write, so this is a perfectly good answer as it stands, but I'd like to put them together. I'd like to look at what the total top component is and what the total bottom component is. So for the top components, so first of all, everything has this overall factor of a half, which I've pulled out. The top component of this one is 1 times e to the plus. The top component of this is 1 times that. And I said that was 1, but there's this overall minus sign that's there. Okay? So it works pretty much the same below, except here I'm going to have a plus. And as a final step, let me remind you that e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta divided by 2 is cosine theta. So what I'm going to have in this lower component is cosine of omega bt. And e to the I theta minus e to the minus I theta divided by 2i is equal to sine theta. Okay, so putting this stuff together, overall factor of e to the minus I omega at. The bottom, we've said, is cosine of omega bt. And the top, in order to make it work, what I want is to have the opposite sign, and I need an I in the denominator. So if I, well, let me just multiply top and bottom by I, and then pull out the minus sign, and what I've got then is minus I sine of omega bt. Okay, so if I plug in time equals zero, I'm supposed to get what I started with, and you can see I do, because cosine of zero is one and sine of zero is zero. As time goes on, I'm going to pick up an imaginary part in the upper component, and these things are just going to oscillate back and forth. Okay, well, where it started with this particular starting value.
And it has the h equals I, because it's, you get the e to the I.
Yes, so I also made a particularization of that Hamiltonian. So different starting positions would change everything around. Different Hamiltonians would be a completely different problem. Nothing that I said would be relevant. If I started with different starting conditions, then the alpha 1 and alpha 2, I need to calculate those, but a lot of this stuff would follow through similarly. Well, I claim that that's the answer. When in doubt, check, right? Trust but verify. So the claim is that the Hamiltonian times that psi is supposed to be I h bar times the time derivative of that psi. So let's do that. Let's calculate what the time derivative of that psi is. So there are two pieces, right? There's time dependence here and there's time dependence here, so we can use the product rule. If we take the time derivative, if we take the time dependence of that, we're going to bring down the minus I, which is going to cancel this I, so we're going to get h bar omega A times that same thing that it was before, which I'm going to abbreviate as minus I, S for sine, C for cosine. Or we could take the exponential goes along for the ride, right? I shouldn't forget that. Or the derivative could hit the other term, and what I'm going to have then is I h bar, and then the same factor of e to the minus I omega at. And when the time derivative hits sine, it's going to turn it into a cosine, so I'm going to get minus I omega b cosine of omega bt. And when I take the derivative of cosine, I'm going to get a minus sine. Oops, I'm still going to get that minus I omega b, and then I'm going to get the sine. What? There's no minus I. There's a minus omega b, and then sine of omega bt. Okay? Do I get that same thing if I have the Hamiltonian operate on psi? So the Hamiltonian is h bar omega a b b a, and then our wave function has an overall factor of this e to the minus I omega a t, and otherwise it's minus I sine times cosine. Okay, so simple matrix multiplication. The h bar omega and the e to the minus I omega at all go along for the ride. And here I have this times this, so I'm going to get minus I a sine from this term, and I'm going to get plus b cosine from that term. And here I'm going to get a minus IB sine plus A cosine. I don't know if we want to look at the details here, but this is the same as that, right? The A comes out, and we have the minus I sine, and this is the same thing as that. Cosine upstairs, sine downstairs. Okay? So, take-home lessons, how to find the eigenvector values the way you would have in linear algebra, right, by taking the determinant, then solving for a non-trivial solution to the set of linear equations, the normalization procedure, the expansion procedure from the initial state, where we just figure out what those alphas are by dotting the eigenvectors with the initial state, and then the time dependence we can do just by tacking on e to the minus I omega t. And the result then solves this equation, solves the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Are we happy and carefree? Or carefree and happy? Which A or B? Do they commute, right? I don't know, does happiness and carefreeness commute? Sometimes.
So what we did there is we said we had some initial value for the Hamiltonian.
Some initial value for the state.
Okay. And then we just sort of...
And we saw how that state evolved in time. And we could have done that with any other, so I mean, it's just like mechanics, right? You need to know the initial position and the initial velocity to know what the future is. So here we needed to know what the initial value of psi was, and we could propagate it into the future. Okay, so we have one other bit of business that I was hoping to accomplish today, and it's just mathematics, so it ought to be simple. It's what I was taught as the CBS inequality. There's kind of a surplus of dead mathematicians. So this is Cauchy, Bernachevsky, Schwartz inequality. Our book just calls this the Schwartz inequality. Cauchy goes pretty far back. So my guess is that Cauchy did it first. And the reason there are so many names for this inequality is it comes up in lots of different contexts. So it was proved again and again and again and again. The most general proof we need for this is for the inner product space, the Hilbert space. But let's take a look at what this is in kind of normal sort of notation. So, you know, in 191, A dot B was the magnitude of A, the magnitude of B, times the cosine of theta. And therefore, A dot B squared was the magnitude of A squared, the magnitude of B squared, times cosine squared of theta. And cosine squared of theta is at most 1, so this thing is less than or equal to the magnitude of A squared, the magnitude of B squared. So that's the Cauchy-Schwartz inequality. The dot product squared is less than the magnitude of the vectors squared, and that's kind of necessary then to have, you know, this thing be a fraction of that so that this can be just a cosine of theta. So if we write this out in terms of bras and kets, what this is going to say is, now our dot products can be imaginary, so instead of this just being a square, this is going to have to be the complex absolute value, that this thing here is less than the magnitude of A, and we carefully made that was a real number, right? Vectors had to have real lengths times the magnitude of B. This is what we want to show. Well, if we kind of think about a way to proceed from three-dimensional space, if I have two vectors, A and B, how could I cut B down to size? How could I make B as small as possible? And if you think about it, what I want to do is I want to remove as much as I can of B using this vector A. So what I want to think about then is B minus the dot product of B and A hat. So that's removing the biggest possible piece of B. And therefore, the magnitude of this vector is going to be as small as possible. Incidentally, we could come to the same conclusion, kind of mathematically, by just saying, if I have some value x, what x is going to minimize that quantity? And just do it as a problem in calculus. So undoubtedly, that's how this trick was discovered the first time. But with complex numbers, that turns out to, although it works great for real numbers, it looks a little bit ugly when these things are vectors and x, when these things are complex vectors and x is a complex number. So instead, let's just start with that. So consider B minus BA in the A direction. Now here I was taking off the unit vector, so I better divide this by the magnitude of A itself. I do want to make sure I'm doing this in the right order. So I am doing this in the wrong order. This wants to be AB. And that turns out kind of the trick that's involved in the complex number piece of it. So let's look at the magnitude of this vector, which I claim is as small as I can make the vector in this exact same sort of sense. Whatever this thing is, it's going to be greater than or equal to zero. And if you think about it, the only way this thing would equal zero is if A was in the direction of B, so I could actually take off 100% of B. So the only circumstance where this thing is going to equal zero is going to be where A and B are proportional vectors. Okay, so all I need to do is to do this process, and since this is absolute value squared, what I need to do is to take the complex conjugate of this, the Hermitian conjugate, I should say, and then do the dot product. So if I take the Hermitian conjugate of this thing, what I'm going to get, I'm going to turn my kets into bras. Now you remember that when you take the complex conjugate of one of these brackets, the order switches around. So this is going to be BA, and the magnitude of A is a real number, so nothing's going to happen. Oops, this guy should have been turned around. And then I've got B minus AB A divided by A. Whatever that thing is, it should be real because it's a magnitude square, and it should be greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so now it's just a matter of expanding things out, right? So I've got that term there. I've got this term here, which is going to be minus, this is the order that's going to be BA. This guy here is in the order that is AB. And this is a real number. And I've got this term here, which is going to be just exactly the same term, right? Because now I'm going to get AB, and I had this BA, and I'm going to be dividing it by that guy. So I've got two of those guys. And finally, I've got this, which is going to be plus, because the two minus signs cancel. So here I have a BA, and here I have an AB, and here I have a AA, and I divide it all by AA squared. Oh, well, these two terms are the same. right? Because one of those things cancels out. So what I've got then is that BB minus, there's now just one of these left, and this thing here is the magnitude of AB squared, since it's it times its complex conjugate, divided by the length of A squared, that's greater than or equal to zero. And if I just put this to the other side of the equation and bring the AA up, I've got the CBS inequality. Ta-da! Why bother with the mathematics? Well, so this is going to be the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Next lecture. This is what we needed to show Heisenberg uncertainty in the most general sense. I remind you that we could have proven Heisenberg uncertainty in terms of position and momentum just from Fourier transform properties, but this will give us a generalized version of Heisenberg uncertainty that includes lots of things, but not the energy time version of Heisenberg uncertainty. So delta x delta p is greater than or equal to h bar over 2. That stands, that has a different status than the statement that the uncertainty in energy times the uncertainty in time is greater than h bar over 2. This guy is really fundamentally different from the one that's above it. And so it's going to take many words in order to explain what the bottom one is. I don't know, so this should look pretty unrelativistic, right? Position and time should have the same status in any good bit of physics. And of course it does when we do relativistic quantum mechanics, which we won't. But kind of the unhappy fact is that instead of the bottom one becoming like the top one, which is easy to prove and we'll prove it, what happens is the top one becomes like the bottom one. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in relativistic quantum mechanics is a little bit trickier than it is in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Enough amazement for one day.